Robert Lifton wrote a remarkable book called The Climate Swerve, Reflections on Mind, Hope, and Survival. I recommend it. Robert Lifton, L-I-F-T-O-N, the famous man who's Robert Lifton. The Climate Swerve, Reflections on Mind, Hope, and Survival. In this book, he examines the psychological reaction we have to the threat of nuclear annihilation on the one hand, which was especially prominent during the Cold, during the debacle of the Cold War, but also the creeping threat now of climate change and what Tom Singer has called extinction anxiety. Both, he says, call forth the dissociative defense of psychic numbing. Quote, here's Lifton. Such numbing has to do with the mind's resistance to the unimaginable extremity of the catastrophe, to the infinite reaches of death and pain. We find ourselves continuously searching for and also resisting images that might help us to take in what is an unprecedented phenomenon. With both nuclear and climate threats, we have trouble imagining the real. No wonder we tend to see each of them as beyond description or comprehension, as driven by otherworldly forces that render us tiny and helpless, rather than as lethal mechanisms we ourselves have created and are quite capable of understanding. Both call forth the unmanageable imagery of extinction and lead to psychic numbing, the human equivalent of the way animals freeze, sometimes called playing dead, when threatened and lacking a path of either resistance or escape. Pardon?
It's also a trauma response.
Yeah, it's typical. The widespread numbing created by nuclear and climate imagery of extinction can be understood as playing dead on the part of the majority of people on Earth. Now, playing dead is a dissociative defense, right? Okay. Now, fake news and defenses against reality. As we have seen, trauma survivors often become orphans of the real. Reality has assaulted them with too much too soon. Fear floods their fragile egos, and soon archetypal defenses grow up around their vulnerabilities to avenge the wrongs of their unfair treatment and protect them from further feelings of humiliation and shame. Soon they are living in an altered reality. Our current president is a master of such illusionism, identified as he is with the bright angel in the self-care system. It started very early in his presidency, perhaps you remember this. He expected the biggest crowd ever imaginable in the world at his inauguration. And when people pointed out that it was about half the size of Obama's crowd, he claimed that the press was vilifying him and denigrating him and not giving him full credit. I forget his press secretary.
Spicer.
Yeah, Spicer, and said this was not true, and it was the press trying to minimize his enormous support, and Kellyanne Conway told the public that Spicer had simply offered alternative facts to the ones believed by journalists. And later, Trump accused the press of persecuting him and insulting him, complaining to a reporter that they demean me unfairly. He then pointed to a photograph of the crowd that he claimed was from a better angle. I call it a sea of love, he said. Ford Davies, who wrote a book William Davies, his book is called Nervous States, Democracy and the Decline of Reason. Davies says this is an example of how polarized emotions smother rational discourse. Quote, for Trump, this was no mere disagreement over facts. It was an opposition between two emotions, the arrogant sneer of his critics and the love of his supporters. In the light of the analysis I'm pursuing in this essay, these polarized emotions are none other than the two angels in the dissociative system with which Trump alternately identifies. Okay, I recently took a walk in an arroyo in Santa Fe, and I was looking up at a flock of stellar jays. I don't know whether you've ever seen stellar jays, but they're very beautiful deep blue birds, and they rarely come down into the Santa Fe area from the surrounding mountains, but I was looking up, and a pleasant couple happened by with walking their dog, and they said, "Ah, looking at the chemtrails, are you?" I said, "No," and I looked up again, and I could see the jet contrails, you know, making crisscross patterns in the sky. They frequently fly over New Mexico. And I said, "You mean the contrails?" And she said, "No, chemtrails." "You didn't know about chemtrails?" I said, "No, I didn't know about chemtrails." And they said, "Well, it's pretty well known. The government is involved, you know, in changing the weather down here." I said, "Really?" I realized I was going down the rabbit hole. And they said, "You can Google it if you want." So I went home and Googled it. And guess what? There on Google is a whole chemtrail conspiracy theory that has to do with how the government is either trying to poison us or is trying to change the weather or in other ways manipulate the environment through the spraying of chemicals from jet exhaust fumes. So I began to wonder, how widespread is this stuff? And then I read Kurt Anderson's best-selling book called Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire, A 500-Year History. Now, if you haven't read Kurt Anderson's book, and I don't subscribe to everything he says, he's a rationalist, so he takes great exception to anything that's irrational, and, you know, those of us in depth psychology are aware that there are many irrational things that happen on the face of the earth. But anyway, he points out that we Americans have always been wide-eyed idealists, true believers, passionate dreamers, but that lately various cultural and technological developments have taken us over the edge, he says, and down the rabbit hole. Among these developments, Anderson highlights the substitution of opinions for facts. And this he traces to the fact that there was a repeal during the Clinton administration of the Federal Fairness Doctrine, and how the subsequent vacuum, when the Fairness Doctrine was eliminated, was filled by talk radio, and Rush Limbaugh rushed into the vacuum. He points out that it used to be that all of us got our news through three major networks, so that the news was standard, whichever network you tuned into. That after the Fairness Doctrine, with the advent of these extremist talk radio shows, we started getting our news only in silos, in particular biased media. He also points out that the internet amplifies the problem, because what you can find on the internet, like about chemtrails, looks like news. And a lot of people, many, 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 I don't know what percentage, but it's frighteningly large, get their news from the internet. Mm-hmm. So people are getting news, so-called news, from, which is really just opinions, and a lot of it's by crackpots. So there's a lot of extremist stuff out there. His statistics are frightening. He says that roughly 25% of us believe that the government and its co-conspirators are hiding all kinds of monstrous truths from us concerning assassinations of presidents, the presence of extraterrestrials. Down in New Mexico, we have Roswell. The genesis of AIDS, how vaccines cause autism, and so forth. This same percentage believes that Barack Obama was born in Kenya and that he is the Antichrist. 20%. That the U.S. was complicit in the 9/11 attacks, and that the media or the government are adding secret mind-controlling technology to television broadcast signals. He says he figures that there's roughly 1 million in the population who have beliefs that are extreme enough to be symptomatic of mental illness.
Patients in the state hospital knew this a long time ago.
Yeah, they all knew this, right. So this next section is the education of Alex Jones.
Oh,
you know Alex Jones?
Yeah.
Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire, a 500-year history. Alex Jones began his career in the 90s and has thousands upon thousands of followers, as well as an annual income of at least $20 million. In 1995, he accused the U.S. government of planning the Oklahoma City bombing. Then, 6 years later, he made a similar claim about the September 11th attack. He sees climate change as a hoax perpetrated by a new world order of financial elites who profit by fueling exploitable hysteria. Evil work lurks everywhere for Alex Jones. But the most flagrant delusion, and the one that has promulgated over the airwaves and the internet for 7 years now, is the massacre of 20 innocent children by Adam Lanza at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. Alex Jones says it never happened. Just like the minister in this film.
He's losing court about that recently.
Yeah. Well, this is what I'm going to tell you. It never happened. It was a false flag operation engineered by the gun control advocates to drum up support for taking our guns away. In Jones's language, no one died. It was a synthetic, completely fake event with actors. Now, the reason I got interested in this is because recently, Alex, a number of these families in Newtown, Connecticut, sued him for defamation and for harassment, because apparently some of these families were being harassed by members of the extreme right because they were protesting that nothing was being done about the violation of their killing of their kids. So a man by the name of Wartzel, I think it's Ted Wartzel, anyway, Charles Wartzel, published an article in the Times on March 31st this spring called Why Courtrooms Are Kryptonite for Alex Jones. And the article described a three-hour deposition under oath as Jones was questioned by attorneys hired by these 10 families who had sued him for defamation. And he broke down under this questioning, which was fascinating. At first, he resisted all of the questioning, totally out of control. He was forced to admit that his confidential sources were really nothing more than message board trolls and cranks. And Alex Jones had one moment. First of all, he tried desperately to divert, saying everything was fake news, that what he was being told was, or what he was being accused of. He was asked to actually read the transcripts out loud of medical personnel that went in and saw these dismembered bodies of these kids that had been shot in the face by Adam Lanza. Vivid descriptions. And then he was asked to watch his own denial. And in other words, this was a moment like Connie had in jail. Okay, he had to look at his own complicity with evil, and he had to be stopped. Because the lawyer said, that's not a response. You're not responding. Finally, he broke down, started weeping, and said that he was almost psychotic in an earlier time in his life, and that he really did believe that all these things were staged. But he's now realizing, thanks to the questioning of the lawyers, that not everything was staged. But then he went on to his next victim story was mental illness. Okay, so anyway, it was a fascinating study in the authoritarian personality breaking down. He had one moment where he had to look directly into the face of his own complicity with evil. He couldn't stand it. Okay, wrestling with our angels. Let's see. Guns as angel weapons. Mass murder in America. I grew up with guns in a family of outdoorsmen. My father, grandfather, and uncles all hunted. I knew the heady power of shooting guns, the explosive power when you pull the trigger, the speed and impact of bullets or shot charges, the thrill of hitting moving targets at a distance, the power to kill an animal or bird, and the ritual of cleaning and eating wild game. This is where I grew up. Having a gun in your hands is having immediate access to archetypal power. Power that amplifies the limited power of the body. Powers of great warriors, heroes, gods. Guns make you strong and powerful. Knowing how to use a gun makes you special in the eyes of men. Guns make others afraid. Guns are powerful defenses. 880 volts of untransformed power. Guns are angel weapons. I know these things because my loving father, who is a talented professional man with a big local reputation and many creative abilities, was also angry and afraid. Afraid of blacks, afraid of communists, afraid of anti-gun liberals who might take our guns away. My father grew up in a neighborhood in Detroit where he was bullied and picked on. He was a skinny kid, weak with asthma, but he built himself up by boxing and weightlifting, and then he bought guns. Teddy Roosevelt was his hero. He would regale me with stories of the Wild West and how the Colt revolver was the great equalizer on the frontier, making even the weak men strong, and how an armed militia was the best defense against a possible takeover of the country by communists. He kept one of these Colt revolvers in his bedside table and practiced at night what he called dry firing, where he would take his bullets out, sit in his easy chair, and dry fire at Indians riding horses around wagon trains on TV westerns. Once, he accidentally shot out the television set after reloading his gun, falling asleep, and waking up to the sound of the cavalry charge. My mother, who heard the report, came down, found him with a smoking gun in his hand, thought he had killed himself, but he was only, he said, defending the household against menacing Indians. He was a character. So I inherited all these guns from my father, and I now am here to tell you that I have given them all up. I have sold them all 10 years ago after a significant spiritual crisis following the viewing of the movie War Horse with my wife, Robin. And if you want to read that story, it's in a book that was just published by Luke Hockley called my article is called Getting Your Own Pain, a personal account of healing dissociation with the help of the film War Horse. It's in the Routledge International Handbook of Jungian Film Studies. So you can read this story. I had no idea that there was a pocket of guilt and dissociation in my psyche about all the innocent animals I had killed as the son of my father. And this whole pocket of material was completely isolated. Never came up in my analyses, never came up in all the work I've done on myself until I went and saw this film. And there's a moment in the film where the young boy who has fallen in love, really, with this beautiful stallion, who then is conscripted as a soldier into the war, and the stallion's conscripted into the war to pull cannons, and they meet on the front, and the horse is charged off through no man's land and become, I don't know if any of you have seen the movie, but he's almost died, and the veterinarian says, this horse has to be put down. And there's one moment. First of all, he aims his gun at the horse's head, and the boy whistles. And that whistle is the note that brought this horse to him when he had first trained it 10 years earlier. And the horse raises his head and looks around, and then a second time, and a third time. The horse is saved, but that was enough. I was completely undone by this movie in these moments. I was in tears. I couldn't understand why I was making a scene in the film. Robin was trying to put her arm around me and hold me. I just couldn't get over it. And then I went home that night, and she tried to convince me that I must have been affected by that movie because of all the hunting I had done, all the animals I had killed. And I said, no, that's a typical feminine reaction.
I'm glad he says that.
I grew up a man. I was a boy. I hunted with my father, my grandfather, all the rest of them, and this is part of a male initiation. And good God, you think your food comes from a grocery store? It doesn't. I'm here to tell you. I went on and on. Then I went to bed, and it was like a separate file in my psyche, just sort of downloading all night long about the innocent birds I'd killed, about the cat I shot in the head with the revolver, about everything I had done as a so-called